Let's start. So we'll not wait for Dennis and see how he takes it. Any questions from yesterday? So let me start with a review of what we saw yesterday. We were playing around with toy models of many body wave functions, where we were placing some constraint on the type of entanglement we could see. In particular, we were assuming that there was only short range entanglement. And in 1D, things were very clear. So with the, very clear. We obtained the ability to see to recover the logarithmic correction to entanglement by assuming that the entanglement of a block or region A, this is region A, right, with the rest of the system, so region A is all this. If we could think of the entanglement as being made of different contributions corresponding to the different length scales. So region A, we would have, we identify different length scales, right? The original site, groups of two sites, groups of four sites. And for each of those, we assume that there is an entangled pair between inside and outside across the boundary of the block, okay? So in this case, we would obtain two EBITs from these two, from the two boundaries at this length scale, two EBITs from this other length scale, two EBITs from this other length scale. And when we add them together, we see that if A had size, if the size of A was L, L sides in there, then we had to repeat this log to L times, and that implied already that then the entropy in this very simple toy model for a wave function would scale as 2 times log to L, right? And this was reproducing the logarithmic correction to the boundary law that we observe in critical systems in one dimension. So then the key then is to think that entanglement is something that appears at different length scales. Each length scale contributes to the entanglement of a block. So more pictures, right? So here what I'm saying is I'm going to study how much contributions we get as we change the size of the block. Right, and what I'm saying is, if the block is very small, if L is equal to 2, we only get short range contributions from short distances. So we get that the entropy for L equal to 2 is just 2. Right? So see, this thing here means you take a block and you break it into contributions. Right? You look at the entanglement; it's a sum of contributions. So now let's look at the effect of that. Let's take a small block. Since the block is small, it only the entanglement is only made of contributions coming from short range, from a small scale. If we take a larger block, say 4 sites, then we see that we have 2 types of contributions, right? From the smallest length scale and from the next length scale. So S of L equal to the entropy in this case is equal to 4. Okay. We now consider an even larger block, and then we see that we have several contributions again. From different length scales. What's changing is that as we consider a larger block, there are more length scales that can contribute to the entropy, right? So then for L equal to 8, we see that the entropy becomes 8, right? Sorry, 6, should be 6, right? And so on, right? For each length scale is contributing equally to the entropy of the block. How many length scales contribute to that? Well, this depends on the size of the block. Now, the same type of toy model works to explain what we saw numerically. We saw that as a function of, say, log L, right, as we change the length scale, then the entropy sometimes had, so the entropy of the block, it had, at criticality, it had this behavior, which was a log of L. But of criticality, we would see something like it follows this trend, but then it saturates to a constant. Well, you can see it here, right? Imagine that not all length scales can contribute to entanglement. Imagine that only a small length scale, say the first two small, the two smallest length scales could contribute to entanglement. Imagine now a toy model where there is no long-range entanglement. Then what we see is that we start with a small block. There is some amount of entropy. We change the size of a block, we increase the size of a block, then there is another length scale contributing to it, so we are here, we're growing. But then as we consider even larger blocks, right, there are no new contributions. We're missing the yellow contribution here. And so that implies that the entropy saturates. And now, doesn't matter how large I make the block, right? I can make my block very, very large. There will only be two types of contribution on each boundary, and that explains the saturation. Okay? So, and then we also had a look at two dimensions. Remember that if we only had short-range entanglement, we obtained the boundary law in all dimensions, but we were trying to obtain the logarithmic corrections in two dimensions. And we tried the same trick. We tried to think that our region A could, the entropy on region A could be the sum of contributions coming from different length scales. But what we saw there is that this did not produce a logarithmic correction at all, okay? And the reason for that was clear, that in here we have, at this length of scale, short-range entanglement is contributing some amount which is proportional to the size of the boundary, which is L, right? Now, we change length of scale and we say we want contributions there, but how much? Well, it's going to be proportional to L effective, right? The length, as we change length of scale, here we had 8 sides per side, right? Here we have 4 sides effectively. So that's L effective is L over 2, right? And then here, as we consider even larger length of scale, L effective has become original L over 4, right? And now if we add all these contributions, we realize that this is has to be proportional to L, right? Times 1 plus 1 half plus 1 fourth. And we can go on, right? This could be, L could be very large. The important thing is that all these contributions in 1D were 1 plus, or 2 plus 2 plus 2, right? It was a constant. Here it's a series that converges and it's always smaller than 2. So this is equal, or it's upper bounded by 2L, right? This is still a boundary law, okay? So we are left with the question, well, can we find another toy model, maybe a bit more elaborated, that would be able to reproduce the logarithmic correction that we see in fermionic systems once we have a Fermi surface in two dimensions? And the answer is that yes, that we can do that. And what we have to do is to generalize a bit these ideas that we were describing. So you could think of these different contributions to entanglement as what you would find if you define some form of renormalization group transformation in which you have a look at your system at different length scales, okay? That is related to some notion of renormalization group transformation, and where at each length scale you just pay attention to entanglement at that length scale, right? So imagine you take a picture of your system at some length scale and you just count how much short-range entanglement you have at that length scale. Now you take a picture of your system at another length scale, and you look at how much entanglement you have at that length scale, and you do that, right? And then you add all these contributions. So it turns out that, therefore, that implicitly we are talking about the renormalization group here. And what we need to do to build a toy model capable of reproducing logarithmic corrections into dimensions is to generalize our notion of renormalization group. So usually we think when we have a system, if we look at it from far away, it behaves like another system, right? But what happens if your system, when you look at it from far away at low energies, what if it behaves as if you had two systems, okay? And think about spin charge separation, right? You can have a lattice, so in the phenomenon of spin charge separation, this is a well-known phenomenon. Say in one dimension you have a wire, quantum wire. It's described by, electrons hopping in 1D, interacting with themselves. So what you see at low energies is that this one-dimensional system, and I insist, one single one-dimensional system, this quantum wire, at low energies, if you look at the excitations, it behaves as if it had two systems, one next to each other. One for the spin degrees of freedom, some effective spin degrees of freedom, and one for the charge. What this means is that if you have your system in 1D, and you probe it locally, you perturb it here, what you see is that there will be some wave that propagates in the system, but actually it's not one wave, there are two. And they go at two different speeds, okay? There are two different sets of degrees of freedom that at low energies react independently of each other. They you could not have one of these waves crossing the other without even seeing each other. And the natural way of describing this process is by saying at low energies, this splits into two independent systems. Okay? So I want you to keep this in mind, that as you look at a single many-body system at low energies, it may have several surprising effects. Maybe it behaves as two different systems. So let's do that. Let's do that applied to this toy model. Let's assume that our many-body wave function, when we look at log distances, it factorizes into two many-body wave functions for subsets of degrees of freedom that don't talk to each other. Okay? So if we did that, and this happens every time we change length of scale, what we would see is that at this original length of scale, we'll have some contributions that we describe and will give us the amount of entanglement that we would have would be L, right? Now we go to the next length scale, and again, we'll have some amount of entanglement, which will be proportional to this L effective, which is equal to L over 2. But imagine that actually, at long distances, our system behaves as if there were two components. And each component is contributing the same amount of entanglement, right? So then we'll have to take this contribution times 2, right? And at the next length scale, so I'm saying this branches into two systems. And as we change length scale, each of the systems branches again into two systems. If we do this, then we see the effective boundary here is L over 4, but we have 4 copies, right? And what we see then is that when we add these copies, we have the total contribution is L of 1 plus then 1/2, but we have 2 copies, plus 1/4, but we have 4 copies, etc. And this happens log L times again, right? So this is L times 1 plus 1 plus 1, etc. And this happens log L times. And this is L log L. Okay? So this is a bit esoteric. There is some RG idea here floating around. Some exotic way of thinking about what happens when you change length scale. But you see that that within this toy model, we obtain the logarithmic correction. Also in 2 dimensions. And it turns out that next week we'll see that there is a tensor network that uses this idea to be able to reproduce the logarithmic correction in 2 dimensions. Good. Any questions? I'm sorry? So actually, using these ideas, you could go all the way to having the entropy of a region of size, linear size L. So yeah, that is L square. You could do that. You can engineer all types of scalings, right? So this will be now the bulk law, right? The amount of entropy is proportional to the size of the region. You could go all the way to that. Now, when we look at systems of free fermions, we seem to stop here for local Hamiltonians, ground states of local Hamiltonians. And so what this type of situations, they don't seem to be relevant to physics, but maybe they will become. Excellent. So any other question?
So we're explaining here the fact that I have scaling variance and I'm considering long range directions.
Yes.
Why is it valid to consider that the
So we don't know what the rules are of the game, but I would argue that if I start here and I tell you that the way to change scale to go from here to here is by splitting the system into 2 pieces, or if I come here and I say the way to change scale is take the system and split into 2 pieces, I'm giving the same rules at all length scales, right? So there is some generalized notion, if you want, of a scale invariance that would justify this. These ansatz, right? It's not the usual one, usually we think of the RG flow as simply, you know, you have your space of parameters, say the Hamiltonian, and as you change scale, you move in that space. Well, what we're saying here is maybe there is more to it. Maybe there are physical systems in which, as you change scale, your point becomes two points in you know, you have two copies of your system. Okay? And actually, fermionic systems with a Fermi surface, you can try these ideas, see whether the wave function can be factorized in this way, and there are situations where it actually happens. This is as simple as free fermions hoping on a square lattice. But I have to say this is research that is being done nowadays. So there was, and it's actually being done part of it at perimeter, and it's, you know, it's we don't know where this is going yet. It's very recent. All right. So then I decided that I would break the final lecture into two lectures, the final lecture on many-body entanglement. That was yesterday. Obviously, we didn't finish yesterday. And I'm going to continue with the same. It's about the boundary law, but I'm going to change the title. So that's going to be a lecture. The first day, I gave you a schedule with all the lectures. So I'm just adding lecture 10 there, which is not tensor networks yet. And I had the title, oh yeah, entanglement as a theoretical tool. So what I want to discuss is ways in which nowadays we use entanglement to learn about many body physics. The first observation, or part, what's that? First I want to discuss universality. And there is a notion of universality which is well known, which is that certain systems behave in a given in a way that is universal, in the sense that there are many, many systems behaving in the same way, maybe when you bring them near a critical point, or when you look at the fixed point of the RG flow, so when you look at them at low energies. But the observation here is that there is a more general notion of universality, that we found the same type of scaling of entanglement, the boundary law, or maybe corrections to it, which applies to all types of systems. So this is not we take all the systems and we group them into a finite number of classes. It's all the systems obey these simple laws. Okay, so there is this extended notion of universality. But then I also want to talk about this normal notion of universality. So in this case here, just let me say that in this more general notion, we say that we believe there is some deep connection between the Hamiltonian being local and the ground state obeying an area law, the boundary law. Okay, but what this means, it's not very well understood. So this is ongoing research as well. Can we prove that if we have a local Hamiltonian, then the ground state necessarily obeys the boundary law? Can we write the theorem about this? Well, it turns out that if the Hamiltonian is local and in one dimension, that there has been a lot of progress in this direction. And generally, we expect the boundary law. But in two dimensions, we don't even know. We don't even know, right? So you can use arguments from field theory where everything is easy in field theory, or relatively easy compared to the lattice. And then we would be able to argue that if you have a mass gap in your spectrum, then there will be a boundary law. Okay, but the situation is not clear at all. So there are lots of open questions there. Can we rigorously prove that the boundary law is a reflection of locality in the Hamiltonian? We don't know. All right, so then going back to these more specific scenarios using the notion of universality in a more concrete way, we could study quantum critical phenomena. So universality, let's see, I'm confused about, okay. So this observation was A, right? We don't know exactly what's going on, but we suspect that a boundary loss is a deep reflection of locality. And B, let's look at quantum critical quantum criticality. Which has to do in 1D, which has to do with, it's closely related to CFTs, conformal field theories in 1 plus 1. And I understand that those who have been learning about string theory know a lot about CFTs, so this is a way of making a connection to those lectures. So what I want to say here is that those who know about this, that's for them. Those who don't know, that's just to get the big picture, an idea of what we can use nowadays, the entanglement to what the entanglement can be used for as a tool, as a theoretical tool. And so a CFT is characterized by a conformal data. So if you give me the conformal data of a CFT, I know everything I need to know. I can completely characterize that CFT, right? There are many conformal field theories, and conformal data is the minimum information you have to provide to know exactly which conformal field theory we are talking about. And there is, so this is given by the central charge. And we've been seeing C, central charge, appearing in front of the log, the logarithmic correction in 1D, and then a set of primary fields. So there is a distinguished set of operators in the theory, which are these primary fields, I alpha. And for those, what we want to know is their conformal dimensions. And so this is h and h bar for each alpha. And we want to know the operator product expansion. The coefficients of the operator product expansion, okay? So this is some information, you give it to me, I know exactly what CFT you are talking about. And so this CFT is the one that characterizes the universality class of a quantum phase transition. So if I want to understand my system, I see that my system has a phase transition. If I want to understand which phase transition it is, that amounts to finding what CFT describes that phase transition. That amounts to providing the conformal data, okay? So I give you a critical Hamiltonian, you look at it, well, if you want to understand the system, try to find the answer of what's the central charge, what are the primary fields, okay, and their conformal dimension. So this connects to the scaling dimensions. The two-point correlators in the theory will decay according to some power laws, and these power laws are given, the powers are given by the scaling dimensions, which are just the sum of the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part of the conformal dimension. So these are the scaling dimensions. And then we have the conformal spin. Which is given by H alpha minus H alpha bar. The idea is that there are many other fields in the theory, but all of them are, the rest of them are descendants in some sense of these primary fields. So if you understand how these behave, then conformal invariance implies or characterizes how the rest of fields in the theory behave. Okay? So I give you a critical Hamiltonian on the lattice, and you would like to know all this. And then you're done with the question of what's, you know, characterizing the critical, the quantum critical point. Now, what we've learned is that we can get this part, okay? Because we can study how the entropy scales in 1D, and that's not a big deal. We can do finite size scaling, even if we can only deal with small systems, and obtain that. Yes?
Stupid question, but how do we know that every 100 is
zero? How do we know? We don't know. We don't know. Maybe, right. So this is recorded, and if I go back, you know, and repeat what I said, I hope I said that most of the time we have a CFT associated to the quantum critical point. Right? And so this is not exhaustive. There might be critical points that are not described by a CFT. Right? Not all gapless systems are Lorentz invariant, whereas not even effectively, whereas a CFT assumes a linear dispersion. Right? So in terms of our energies for free fermions, every time that we were, if this was the dispersion relation, and we had something like this, here you see that there is a linear approximation going on. That's good. That's a linear dispersion. If we expand around here, we'll see a dispersion relation that is linear, right? But it could happen that we have situations where we hit the zero in energy, not linearly, but maybe quadratically. And then that's another story. Yeah. But you can also see just by, this is just drawing, right? But the chances that you hit, for any chemical potential, right? If I choose a chemical potential randomly, I'm not going to hit this point, right? And all these cases correspond, there are linear approximations here that would correspond to a CFT. So there might be specific points, specific systems, which are gapless, which are not described by a CFT. That's right. Any other question? All right. So what's happening? We only get the central charge. But luckily, getting the central charge is already often a lot. There are this subset of CFTs, the minimal unitary models. Or unitary minimal models. With central charge. Central charge is given by 1 minus 6 m plus 1 for m equal to 3, 4, etc. Actually, I'm going to mention the first four, so let me just do it this way. And so for this particular, for c equal to 1/2, which is the m equal to 3, we get the Ising CFT. This is one of the one that you found in the tutorial on Wednesday. If we had C equal to the next one, 7 over 10, we get the tricritical Ising model. If we get the next M equal to 5, we would get central charge equal to 4 over 5th, and that would correspond to the 3-state Potts model. And then the next one would be 6 over 7, and that's the tricritical three-state Potts model. And then there are many more. Okay? But the important thing here is that if we look at possible central charges, this is C, we find the Ising model, we find the tricritical Ising model, we find that they form a discrete set, okay? And the important thing is that there are no more other unitary models. So the ones that we can find corresponding to grounds, the ones that we will find in our lattice models for a Hamiltonian, which is Hermitian, are going to be in this class. What we're saying is above C equal to 1, and including C equal to 1, there are many possible CFTs. But under C equal to 1, there is only a discrete set, okay? So if I go and compute entanglement entropy, what does it take, right? I mean, we've done this here. And I look at the scaling, and I can fit the logarithm when I do this in log L. I find that the entropy scales as some constant times log L. If this constant, you know, there is always, this is numeric, there is always some finite accuracy, but we are dealing with a discrete set, right? So if you have enough accuracy that you can distinguish which point we have in this line, then you have completely characterized the CFT, okay? So then we don't need to worry about primary fields or anything, right? So just one single number, if we're in the right regime of central charges, is enough to completely characterize the quantum phase transition. Okay? So that's very powerful. We don't need to study all the primary fields. We don't need to identify them. No. It's all done. We just need to look at how entanglement scales. Okay, similarly, we can have, so that's going to be C. So C, I'm going to talk about topological order. And this is closely related to topological quantum field theories in 2 plus 1. Okay? That's a second application, a second place where entanglement, by looking at entanglement, we can learn a lot. So what do we have in this case? And you've learned about the toric code in a previous course, so I'm just going to go through it quickly. The same way that we need the CFT to characterize, or that the CFT may be able to characterize your quantum critical point, when we have in two dimensions, when we have topological order, what we want to obtain is a description of the emergent anion model. Okay? Characterizing the topological order means finding an answer to the following. This is like the conformal data, now the topological data, if you want. So we want a list of anion types. Okay? A list of anion types. That's the same as saying, as related or analogous to asking for a list of primary fields. And to keep it concrete, since you've seen the toric code, right, I'm going to write here what it was for the toric code. For the toric code, so we'll label them as I. Then the types, anion types, was the identity, the electric excitation, electric flux, magnetic flux, and then the fermionic one. Okay, if you remember that from those lectures. So another thing we want is for each of these anion types, we would like the quantum dimension, their quantum dimension. Okay, so quantum dimension. What do we have here? Well, we call it di. And for the toric code, this for the identity, well, it's an abelian system, and all the anions have the same quantum dimension, equal to 1. Okay, but it's a property that characterizes also the anion model. And then there is this thing is going to play an important role. It's the total quantum dimension defined as the square root of the sum of the quantum dimension square. So this is the total quantum dimension. And this one plays some, in some sense, an analogous role to the central charge in quantum, in the case of a CFT. And so in the toric code, the quantum dimension is equal to 2, right? Okay, and then there are more properties that we could talk about. We could talk about the fusion rules. Yeah.
When you say it's the analog to the conformal charge, if I specify conformal charge, I specify a CFT, right?
Not completely. Only if the central charge is smaller than 1.
Okay.
In general, central charge is not enough. You really need all the conformal data. That's the minimal set that will completely characterize any CFT. So there is an exceptional situation for central charge smaller than 1. So we have fusion rules that basically are describing what happens if you have anion type I and you fuse it with anion type J. So if you look at, you have two anions and you look from far away, what do you see? Effectively, you see some anion type of type K, and the possible such possibilities are described by some metrics of coefficients that tell you whether this happens or not and in how many different ways it can happen and so on. And then we have also mutual statistics, topological self-statistics of these charges. But I'm saying there is much more here, okay? There is much more here. Now, it happens, it so happens that this is a two-dimensional system with a gap. So we expect that the entanglement entropy of a region of size, of linear size L, that the entanglement entropy scales as some constant times L, okay? But this time, this is the leading order in L, but there is also some constant, some extra contribution here. It's not leading order, so it might be hard to find, but it's there. And it's been shown that for systems with topological order, that this is non-universal. So if I have some system with topological order and I change a little bit the Hamiltonian, then the ground state will change also. And this affects this term, the constant here. Okay, but this term here is universal. Meaning that if I take, the toric code, the Hamiltonian, right, and I modify it a little bit, then I look at the ground state, we've changed alpha, but this gamma is exactly the same until we reach a phase transition. Okay, so this is extremely useful. It's extremely useful because now what we can do is we can consider the entropy as a function of L. And this in practice, for instance, nowadays, again, this is ongoing research, and part of which is being done at perimeter. We could consider geometry where our region, A, is part of a cylinder. Okay? And the boundary is given by this part, this, right? So the size of the boundary, sorry, of A. So if our cylinder is very large in this direction and has some length in this direction, L, right? So what we would see is we could consider different cylinders, different Ls, right? And see how this entropy scales here. So I could consider radius 2, 4, 6, whatever. I made up the numbers. And then I look at the entropy of region A, and I obtain some numbers. Okay. And the important thing is that as you reach sufficiently large L, much larger than the correlation length in the system, you see that indeed this follows a straight line. And all you have to do then is to look, extrapolate back to the origin, and you'll find that if the system has topological order, then this will extrapolate to a negative number, and that's going to be minus gamma. Okay? And it's universal. You change now your Hamiltonian a little bit, and many details may change, but you extrapolate back and you get the same number. Yes?
So this works for ground states of topologically ordered systems, but what happens when I have degeneracy? Is that gamma will depend on the linear combination that I take of ground
states? That's right. But when you have degeneracy, usually what you mean is there is degeneracy here already, right? So when you have topological order, there is degeneracy.
Right.
And the degeneracy, what we're assuming here is that we have a prescription. So this expression here is actually valid for certain types in certain conditions. And the conditions are that you have what's identity flux inside the cylinder. There are some technicalities involved here. Okay? But this is a well-defined scenario. Okay? And in the presence of degeneracy, indeed, you have to be careful about writing things without taking that into account. So this would be how entanglement entropy scales when there is neutral flux around the area that you are considering. Right? So if there was some anionic flux inside, then this expression would have to be changed. And if there is a linear combination of ground states, then you would have to, this would again be modified. So maybe the answer, the how to proceed in this case, is technically a bit more involved. But what I'm saying is there is a way of taking that into account. So there's a particular, when there is degeneracy, there is a particular choice of ground state that will obey this rule, this law, and from which you can extract this universal part.
So to speak, I mean, there are situations where I can expect that every ground state will have the same entropy.
Every ground state, no, a subset of ground state will have the same entropy. The linear combinations, again, will have more entropy. And this is only true if we had a billion, for a billion anions. If we had non-abelian anions, then there are ground states that have more entropy than the others. And what's going to happen is that this part here will still be universal, but will depend on the choice of flux that you have going through the boundary. So let's not try to understand. I'm just telling you that there is a prescription for how to handle the case of degeneracy. Okay. And the important point again is that we can just do numerical simulations, get this information, and it turns out that gamma is given by the logarithm of the total quantum dimension D. Okay. So there we are again. It might be very, very hard to study a system of anions, because all these properties we were describing are properties of excitations. These anions are excitations on top of the ground state, and we are struggling to get ground states nowadays. So imagine getting excitations and moving them around to find the fusion rules or the statistics. That is, maybe we'll get there someday, but nowadays the technology that we have is we are getting at the point where we can get ground states. And it turns out that once you have the ground state, if you look at how entanglement scales, you already learn the total quantum dimension, okay? And there are, and so it turns out that, the total quantum dimension is not enough to completely characterize the whole anion model, but in some situations, it's a lot of information already. You can use other pieces of evidence to decide. So this typically gives you, leaves you with 1, 2, 3 options, right? And then you can try to use other arguments to find out what topological order you have. Excellent. Okay, so the last point then, I think, is going to be to talk about going beyond computing bipartite entropy. We first discussed entanglement as the situation where you don't have a product state, right? And if you have, in a many-body system, you have many spins, many sites, there are many ways in which you fail to have a product state. And here we are only looking at, we block all our sites into two blocks, A and the rest, two regions, and we look at bipartite entanglement using entanglement entropy. It sounds like the problem is much more general, and we are just focusing on one particular aspect. So let's see some ongoing effort to go beyond computing just entanglement entropy. And so it's still going to be bipartite. So it's still very limited in scope. We're looking at partitioning the system again into part A and the rest. Okay, but now we're going to not focus just on the entropy.
Billion states that have different total quantum dimension D, but one has a larger one.
Yes.
Shouldn't I expect that the entropy of this system, the entanglement for a fixed L, should be larger than the one that has less total quantum dimension?
Actually, I would have to think about this.
Yeah.
I think that there is a well-known way of modifying this gamma for the case where the flux is non-abelian, and I could give you the answer I think it is, but I may get it wrong. So it's either plus or minus, which is what you're asking me, log of the quantum dimension of that species divided by the total quantum dimension.
But that's okay. That's the expression for the total entropy, right? Not for this species.
you have to let. So my question is, I mean, why do you get a minus sign? Why do you get minus gamma? I mean, why do you expect the entropy to lower as the total domain grows? It seems like as the total domain grows, you get more, you know.
There is some, you can understand this as having the system being more constrained globally. So the entropy is telling you how many degrees of freedom you have in that region. And usually this has to do with the boundary, how large the boundary is, right, through entanglement. But now if you have some constraint in this wave function due to, well, topological order in the end is a non-local constraint on your wave function, this reduces the amount of entropy. And the more complex structure you get for this constraint, then the more you reduce this entropy. Okay.
I think maybe this can be answered as between the correspondence between the bulk and the boundary of your theory description. Because generically, you won't have the boundary can be, that the boundary can be described as by a CFT. You have to choose a particular state in the bulk such that you will have a corresponding CFT description of
yes.
1 plus 1 boundary.
Right.
And if you didn't choose any non-trivial topological sector, there's no constraint on the CFT at all. It's just a free. And then if you choose some particular topological sector in the boundary, then you kind of impose some constraint on the boundary CFT, such that it's have to be another CFT. And the entropy would increase in that sense.
Maybe we can discuss this later. Excellent. So we have the entropy so far. We've been focusing on the entropy of region A, and this is given by some particular function of the eigenvalues of the density matrix on region A. And now the question we want to ask is, well, is that all we want to extract? Or what if we just look directly at the full spectrum? Why do we have to reduce? We have a lot of information about the reduced density matrix, and we just take just a particular function, right? We're collapsing many, potentially many, many eigenvalues into just one number. This was very useful. We learned many things, but is that everything we can do? In recent years, more and more people have started to study this spectrum, the full spectrum of the density matrix, and there is some normal or use formalism for that. That requires that I take these probabilities and I just look at their logarithm, okay? And I take actually the density matrix for part A, and I use it to define some Hamiltonian here. This is a Hermitian operator, so you can always write it as the exponential of some Hermitian operator, and I'm gonna call this entanglement Hamiltonian. And it's not the Hamiltonian of which that we're standing the ground state. Okay, it's another Hermitian operator that you can define. This is because this is a positive defined Hermitian operator. And then I'm going to talk about this as being entanglement energies. Why not? And so what people study is these entanglement energies, the spectrum of this entanglement Hamiltonian, which is the same as studying the spectrum of the density matrix, but it looks nicer if you take the log. And well, that what have we learned doing that? Actually, we have learned many things. So A, let's go back to quantum criticality. And again, I'm talking about those cases that can be described by a CFT in 1 plus 1. Then I already argued that, well, if the central charge is small enough, we can use the entanglement entropy, the scaling of entanglement entropy, to find the central charge and completely characterize the CFT. But what if, say, central charge is equal to 1? Then there are infinitely many CFTs, okay? And there is a family.
Is that just kind of classical
Oh, okay. No, I'm referring to previous lectures. Where, so this is the eigenvalues. These are the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix on part A. Right? So I gave a proper definition a couple of lectures ago. I'm just making the point now that, sure, we have the spectrum. Why do we have to only pay attention to the entropy of this spectrum? What about the whole spectrum? And it turns out that, well, it's been shown in recent times that if you take that you can use the spectrum to distinguish between different CFTs with, say, central charge equal to 1. So there is an infinite family of CFTs with central charge equal to 1, and they correspond to free boson with a given compactification radius. R, okay, and for different values, R can change continuously. For each value of R, you have a different CFT. It turns out that as we said, the scaling of entanglement entropy is only sensitive to the central charge. But it turns out that if you look now at, so we only get C equal to 1 in this case, but if we look at the entanglement spectrum, if we look at all these lambda k's, you can actually determine what's the compactification radius. And then again, in this particular family of CFTs, you are done. You have completely characterized it. Okay, so there is a lot to be learned by looking not just at the entropy, but at the whole entanglement spectrum. Okay, that's one application. And then another application is, again, to topological order. And as we said a moment ago, if we look at the entanglement entropy, we can get the total quantum dimension. But for instance, suppose that I get total quantum dimension equal to 2, then there are many anion models that have this. For instance, the toric coat, or the double semion. There is also non-abelian one, I think the Ising anion model as well. And several more. You could consider two copies of a chiral semion. There are several possibilities which have the same quantum dimension. Now, if we look at the spectrum of the reduced density matrix, and we can go back to the setting we described a moment ago. We have a cylinder, and now we have region A. Right? If we compute just the entropy and which make the radius of the cylinder larger, we can get total quantum dimension equal to 2. But what about if we look at the entanglement spectrum? Okay, and there are some situations, under some circumstances, we'll learn a lot more. So in particular, let me tell you that if we have a chiral topological order, and examples of this would be fractional quantum Hall states, or so-called chiral spin liquids, then what we have, the physics of this, is that we can have a sample of this material, okay? And we have the situation where the system is gapped, okay? So delta energy larger than 0. The bulk is gapped. And so that's what leads to this boundary law, okay? We have a gap system. But if you look at the physics at the boundary, the boundary of the system, there is some gapless, there are gapless modes. You have some degrees of freedom at the boundary, which happens to be chiral. They go in some direction. And they are typically described by a chiral CFT. Okay. And I'm talking here generally. There will be exceptions to everything, but what I'm saying is that if we look now at the entanglement spectrum, okay, there is some not completely understood but very much studied relationship between the physics at the edge. So there is a chiral CFT here. Okay, so this chiral CFT at low energies will have some low energy spectrum that will show some towers of states, right, as a function of momentum. And because it's chiral, it will have some level of, well, there will be some towers, some possible excited states and the ground state and so on. There will be some shape here. We'll have some spectrum. And if you see this spectrum, then you start thinking, okay, this corresponds to this given chiral CFT. And now it turns out that there is some very much studied relationship between the energy spectrum of this chiral CFT and the entanglement spectrum. Okay, so I'm saying this corresponds, say, take our cylinders and look at the boundary of the cylinder. Okay, this is a physical boundary. And the physical boundary, we look at the energy, and it's the Hamiltonian at the boundary is gapless, and it has some spectrum that collapses. So this all this tower will collapse as we consider larger and larger systems. So this is a physical spectrum. Okay? It's the spectrum of the Hamiltonian at the boundary. And now we want to compare this with the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix on region A. Okay? And these eigenvalues are describing the Schmidt coefficients across the cuts between A and B. And it turns out that there is, well, in some situations you can see that this spectrum has the same shape. It looks, so by looking at the entanglement spectrum, you can see what chiral CFT you have. Okay? And so this is a case where by looking at that, we might be able to, well, the Torrey code is not chiral, double semion is non-chiral, but Ising anion model should be chiral. Is that correct, Yudun? The Ising anion model is chiral, right?
Yes.
So, for instance, if we look at the entanglement spectrum of this particular theory, and we find that it follows the chiral CFT, chiral Ising CFT, then the corresponding CFT, then we know which theory we have, right? The total quantum dimension did not tell us which one we had, but when we add the study of the entanglement spectrum, then we can determine which theory we have. All right, so, yes?
So, if you consider here the cylinder has no boundary at all, but when I do the partition, does it mean that I'm like endowing my geometry with a boundary?
No. Right. So you don't need the boundary. But if there was a boundary, then you would have some low energy spectrum at the boundary, right? And now you still don't need a boundary. You can look at the entanglement cut. And these properties are universal. This CFT here, the CFT, the physical CFT at the boundary is a property that is attached to this phase, right? So by looking at the physical spectrum, you will learn about what topology, what anion model you have. And what I'm saying is, in the absence of boundary, you can study the entanglement cut. And in some cases, there is a relationship, close relationship between the two. So I just look at the entanglement cut, I look at the entanglement spectrum of this cut, and I may be able to learn about the chiral CFT if I had a boundary, which I don't have. Okay. So it's time. It's the end of the second week, and I thought I would just summarize what we've seen. So we focused on bipartite entanglement. We started by introducing this Schmidt decomposition and also the entanglement entropy. And then we applied those simple definitions to the case of a many-body system in its ground state. And then we saw that there is this boundary law. Okay, the ground states, remember we had generic states of a many-body system were obeying this bulk law, but ground states of local Hamiltonians obeyed instead the boundary law and possibly logarithmic corrections. And then yesterday and today we tried to understand this boundary law by playing around with toy models write simple wave functions, and we understood that the boundary law follows simply from just thinking that in our system, in our ground state, we only have short-range entanglement, whereas in order to reproduce the logarithmic correction, we have to assume that all length scales in our system contributed to the entanglement. Okay, and then we've talked about entanglement as a theoretical tool to characterize quantum criticality or topological order. We did first that with entanglement entropy, and then I just briefly discussed that we can go beyond entanglement entropy and look at the full spectrum of the reduced density matrix and use that to further characterize both quantum criticality and topological order. So this is all we wanted to see about entanglement, and next week what we're going to do is we've learned something about ground states here. We're going to apply it. We're going to exploit this structure that we're seeing, that we have in the ground states, to build a formalism known as tensor networks that will allow us to efficiently describe ground states, efficiently meaning a cost proportional to the system size only, in one and two dimensions. Okay?